DW Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
Today on the show, how the currency devaluation in India is impacting the informal economy, a visit to China's last Maoist village, a haven for book lovers, and what it means if you cannot read and write, plus online TV stations in Zimbabwe fear a crackdown. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn, Germany. Until last year, India was the world's fastest growing large economy. The government had even dreamed of growth rates of 9 to 10%. But last November, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced a move to demonetize the economy. Large cash notes were being devalued. The idea was to fight corruption and stop politicians buying votes with cash. But most of the banned currency bills were quickly exchanged into smaller notes or deposited in banks, and people with lots of black money found ways to make it clean. As a result, economists say Modi's demonetization has been a failure, and one which has plagued the Indian economy far more than anyone anticipated. This report by Jürgen Webermann is presented by Charlotte Lomas.
What was the company's name? Meru.
It is not easy to find Imran's small textile factory in Mumbai. The streets of the Dharavi slum are narrow and visitors can easily get lost. Imran's factory is on the upper floor of an old house. Inside, 10 young men sew trousers for a company based in Dubai. But some workspaces, usually filled with employees, are now empty.
Our business is running badly. We only have half as many orders as a year ago before the demonetization. Sometimes we have work and sometimes we don't. Some workers have left and returned to their villages.
Imran moved to Mumbai a few years ago. The city attracts poor workers from all regions of India. In Dharavi, thousands of small businesses generate an annual turnover of $1 billion. Like most Indian companies, Imran produces and trades using unofficial cash-in-hand payments. It's estimated that 90% of all workers in India work in the so-called informal economy. Joel is a wholesaler in Dharavi. He sells many products from dried fruits to peanuts. He has had to dismiss some employees and he is angry about it.
Business has declined badly. It's down by 50%. We only make losses. Many shops here in Dharavi have closed. If this continues, we will soon have to live off government handouts.
Joel has lived in Mumbai for 12 years. He says he has never seen a recession like this before. India's economic growth has slowed to 5.7%, according to official reports. A year ago, it was more than 7%. Industrial production in particular has declined. And official data does not even include the losses in the informal sector, says Dharmakirti Joshi, an economist with India's largest rating agency, CRISIL.
I didn't expect the economy to fall to 5.7%, for instance. I mean, we did expect it to go down because GDP had been going down for the last five quarters. Even before demonetization, the economy was slowing. So what it did was this added speed to that slowdown, and it came to 5.7%.
However, there is some hope, Joshi says. A new sales tax law brought into effect in summer may help. Previously, each state in India insisted on having its own regulations, which made things difficult for many companies. Products were often delayed from crossing state borders, and nobody had a grip on this complicated system. Now, there are nationwide regulations. But the new law also makes things complicated for small businesses and dealers, such as Joel. He now has to submit all of his sales data to the authorities three times per month.
It's expensive to do this because I need to hire auditors to help me.
Like most small business owners in Dharavi, Joel doesn't even own a computer to enter the data.
The government had promised that the new sales tax would make everything cheaper, but in fact, prices have risen by 10 to 12%.
Joel's observation is not yet reflected in official inflation rates. Imran's factory also faces big challenges, and his workers, who all live in the Dharavi district, will probably have to move.
The new taxation law has been a real blow to us. We have problems getting a tax number. We will try to move the plant into a proper, more industrial area.
Economists such as Joshi say it will probably be good if small factories organise their finances in a more official way instead of operating below the radar of the authorities. But no one can predict whether the many small businesses will be able to survive. The workers have few alternatives because too few new jobs are being created in the country and most new jobs require skilled labour. Many in Dharavi are angry at the government that promised an economic miracle, which hardly anyone now believes in.
In China, the other Asian megapower, the economy is still booming. Though the People's Republic is a socialist country, it's become quite capitalistic in many aspects in recent years. But one village is defying this rise of modern capitalism. It has vowed to stay true to the values of the Maoist idea of communes. Nanjie is famous across the country, and the Maoist village has become a big hit with nostalgic Chinese tourists. Eva Ramelow reports.
All day long, communist battle songs, folk songs and quotes of Chairman Mao blast from the loudspeakers that hang up the lampposts in Nanjie village. Some 4,000 people live here. At this primary school, the children are about to begin their lessons. The headmistress, impeccably dressed in a brown skirt and a blouse with a large bow, invites us to attend a class. There are about 70 children in this classroom sitting very closely together, and one of them is Jingjing. She is 13 years old and wears large round glasses.
We learn about what a remarkable man Chairman Mao was. Without him, China would not be the country that it is today. It would still be an underdeveloped country. We often hear stories about Chairman Mao's kindness. On special days, we go to events at the central square where there is a statue of Chairman Mao.
Living in Nanjie means being part of a very special community. In the early 1980s, when China began to experiment with capitalism, local party chairman Wang Hongbin went in the other direction. He decided to implement the Maoist idea of communes in Nanjie. The village now owns all economic resources communally, so every inhabitant is a shareholder. Wang Hongbin, who's in his 70s, looks healthy and tanned as he invites us in a reception room filled with heavy wooden furniture.
When we became members of the Communist Party, we promised we would be fully committed. We have to live up to that promise. It's a very long road to a communist society, but I am hopeful for Nanjie. Here we have implemented some communist elements.
A lot has changed within the Communist Party, within the Communist China. How has Nanjie adapted?
We need the outside world. Our 26 enterprises need the outside market with their raw materials, and we sell them the products from our factories. So we are connected to the market economy that exists outside of the village.
Has it happened in the 40 years that he's been doing this that people didn't agree with the communist values? What happens then?
Of course, people can disagree. It's impossible for everyone to have the same beliefs. But if a majority agrees to the Nanjie system, we must be right.
The best part of being a citizen in Nanjie, according to many people here, is that everything is for free. Everyone gets a food cart to buy groceries with, and the local government assigns a house and a job to each villager. The village looks exactly like any other Chinese village, a bit dull perhaps, without any street vendors, but with the wide, tidy streets, well-kept apartment blocks, and a park where children play, it seems a communist vision come true. More than 500,000 tourists flock here every year. Many use one of the open golf carts to take a tour of the village. We are driving across the main village square now, going past the statue of Chairman Mao and large pictures of the Soviet leaders, Lenin and Stalin. We arrive at the botanical gardens, where, for some reason, a replica of Chairman Mao's childhood home has been built. A lady from a town nearby, who is carrying an umbrella against the sun, feels it is important to learn about true communism.
Nowadays, the desires and spiritual values of our lives are not the same as they were in the 1980s. People had less desires back then. Now people are becoming more and more materialistic. So it's good that here we see what the Maoist idea is like, because it is a great idea.
There is also an older man amongst the visitors here today. Nanjie reminds him of better times, he says.
I'm almost 80 years old and have not much to say about the future. I was brought up with Maoist thinking, but nowadays people don't follow Chairman Mao anymore. Only here in Nanjie. What I wish is for communism to be realized right now, but that is only my hope. But if other villages could learn from Nanjie, communism could be realized.
Nanjie village is a trip down memory lane for many tourists. It's an example of good communism, they say. However, as village chairman Wang Hongbin admits, the Maoist village depends heavily on the outside, capitalist economy. So will the Maoist idea continue in the village? Will young people here be satisfied with communal ownership, assigned jobs and free groceries all their lives? One of the teenagers here, the 13-year-old student Jingjing, told me she would like to travel when she grows up. I wonder if this Maoist village will be enough of an adventure for her. For DW, I'm Eva Ramelow in Nanjie Village, China.
The Republic of Zimbabwe was born in 1980 after years of struggle with a stated commitment to build a socialist society. But many of the big dreams have not come true, and a lot of people are now opposing the one-party system and the rule of President Robert Mugabe, who has been in power for more than 3 decades, and he does not like criticism. Tough media laws make it hard for independent reporting, and the pro-Mugabe state broadcaster dominates the news. But now, people with an internet connection have access to several independent online TV stations that offer critical views. SDW's Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, elections are coming up in 2018, and people fear that a crackdown will soon hit these online stations.
My name is Professor Tafumanain, broadcasting live from the capital city.
That is Uvesa Tafumanei from ZIM DITV, one of the many television stations streaming live from Zimbabwe via the internet. Sylvester, who is also known as Sly, set up the online TV together with his brother, Robert. Both used to work for Zimbabwe state broadcaster, ZBC, in the past, but were frustrated with the lack of critical reporting then. Sly worked in the United Kingdom for several years before returning to Zimbabwe to start the online channel. ZIM DITV broadcasts news on current affairs in Zimbabwe for 8 hours per day, and they extend the broadcast when there are breaking news or special issues like protests. About 3 million people are estimated to watch these online TV shows regularly on their mobile phones. That is about half of the smartphone owners in Zimbabwe. Access to critical news is limited in Zimbabwe, where tough media laws for on-air broadcasting cripple radio and TV stations. Online broadcasters are not regulated so far.
We were not afraid because there's nothing wrong that we are doing that put us in a difficult situation in terms of security. Our efforts as ZimDITV is to try and put Zimbabwe on a world map. The president of Zimbabwe, Comrade R.G. Mugabe, said we need to come and invest in Zimbabwe. Whereas for myself, I was outside the country and said you need to come back home and invest. And this is what we are doing. We are implementing the skills that we have learned outside the country.
The state-owned Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, ZBC, is widely watched, but not popular because of its uncritical praise for the government. 34-year-old Mosunyati says the online broadcasters are filling a gap, but she thinks it's a problem that people need access to the internet to watch their programs.
I hardly ever get a chance to watch online television, and I think that is the case with many ordinary people. It is those people who have ready access to internet and who have got the knowledge that online televisions exist, or who choose to go online to watch those kind of televisions. But for the ordinary person, I think what we need to do as Zimbabweans is to open up the airwaves, have more television stations, so that the ordinary person on the street can be able to access as much information as they would want to.
According to official data, over half of the Zimbabwe population has access to the web. That is about 6.7 million. Most of them live in cities and use their mobile phones to access the internet. The online TV stations broadcast mainly in English, though they may have some programs in the major local languages, Shona and Ndebele. An increasing number of people, particularly young ones, now subscribe to one of about a dozen online broadcasters. Some of the stations stream from outside Zimbabwe. Others are located in the country, like 263 Chat. 263 Chat broadcasts daily from Harare.
Hello viewers, welcome to yet another exciting edition.
263, named after the international telephone code for Zimbabwe, shows content you would not see on the state media. For instance, this footage of former ZANU-PF youth leader Godfrey Tsenengamu, who says that President Robert Mugabe must step down.
President Mugabe has abused our political hospitality. Up to this day, he still wants to be on power. I want to say to the president, you have stretched our patience.
263 also reported on the recent assault charges faced by Zimbabwe's First Lady Grace Mugabe in South Africa. State media in Harare never mentioned the issue. I'm in the newsroom with Nigel Mugamu. Naji, as Mugamu is also called here, says 263 Chat started off as a Twitter account and a website some 5 years ago.
But I started to notice the kind of content I was liking. I'm very visual. If you're telling me a story, I like to see pictures, I like to see video. And then I started thinking, you know, there are a lot of people who are like me. And in 2015, we started experimenting with multimedia. Yeah, and so now we've got a multimedia team, and we produce over 100 videos a month. You know, if you use text, you've got to try and explain, oh, there were 10,000 people. But if it's a video, people are free to make up their own minds. All you have to do is show the different angles, just so people can understand. So let's use multimedia to tell the story of Zimbabwe.
Both Naji and Sly believe there's a bright future for online TV in Zimbabwe. But Takura Zhangaja, the former director of the Zimbabwe Media Institute of Southern Africa, a media watchdog, is less optimistic.
The government will definitely keep an eye on them, and it will arrest some of them. It's already arresting people on the basis of Facebook posts. So the risks that are there are that if government knows who you are, they will definitely look for you and arrest you.
Zimbabwe's government wants to quickly enact the Computer and Cybercrime Bill to fight cybercrimes. The new cybercrime law could become effective by the end of this year, and people who are convicted may face up to 10 years in prison. The 2018 presidential election is believed to prompt a crackdown on critical reporting, but 263 Chat and the other online TV stations are set to continue their broadcasts. For DW, I'm Columbus Mavunga in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Nigeria is the second largest economy in Africa, yet it still has a major problem with illiteracy. And even in the capital Abuja, those who can't read and write face major difficulties in day-to-day life. Jens Borchers with this report, presented by Sarah Steffen.
I know how to write name, write animal name and some other things, but to write full letter with correct English sometimes, they give me a problem.
Abubakar Sadiq is an auto mechanic who works in Nigeria's capital Abuja. The official language here is English, but because Abubakar never went to school, he has to rely on what he learned on the streets. Navigating life in the big city can be difficult. For example, if he wants to withdraw money from an ATM. Sometimes he has to take cars to his clients. But he can't write down their address, so he has to remember directions. He has learned how to say phone numbers, which allows him to call the customer who can explain where he needs to go. But how does he find his way through the city if he can't read the traffic signs?
Normally, if we enter this public transport, from there I take the experience.
Like Sadiq, around 65 million people in Nigeria are estimated to be illiterate. That's almost 40% of the total population. The situation is especially bad in the poorer north and northwest regions of the country. There are a number of reasons for this. One is that not enough has been invested in education for decades. Girls are also often forced to marry at a very young age. And if they're lucky enough to get an education, they rarely continue beyond elementary school. For the past 7 years, ongoing fighting between the Nigerian army and the Boko Haram terrorist group has also severely disrupted the education system. When educator Abubakar Haladu is asked about how the government wants to change the illiteracy rate, he acknowledges how serious the problem is.
Nigeria still has about 11.5 million out-of-school children. It is quite a big challenge in our path to sustainable development. And the present government is determined to change these ugly statistics.
But so far, there has been very little improvement. The Nigerian media is increasingly covering the issue of education funding. Where has all the money that was intended for education programs across the country disappeared to? Clear answers are hard to come by. For adult illiterates, like truck driver Muhammad Tuku, improved school education would come too late anyway. He can read Arabic, which he learned at a madrasa where he studied the Quran. But he never went to a public school. His English is poor. He's picked up a little French thanks to his travels through French-speaking countries. He is embarrassed to talk about his lack of education. If Tuku needs to complete a form, for example, he has little choice but to ask for help.
When I go to the bank, an employee helps me. He writes for me. I give him my name, my phone number, everything. He then writes it down.
There are literacy classes for adults in Nigeria, but only very few. Tuku knows how limited his future possibilities are without reading and writing skills.
If I found someone to send me back to school, I would go, even now.
People who know how to read and write can not only fend better for themselves economically, they also gain access to a vast universe of ideas. If you happen to be in Frankfurt, Germany this week at the International Book Fair, you'd get a whiff of the amazing array of different books available in the world. Or you can travel to the city of Portland in the western US state of Oregon. Powell's bookstore there is the biggest independent bookstore in the world. It occupies a whole block of houses. It's a haven for book lovers, as Wolfgang Stufelesser observed. Conor Dillon has the story.
Because you can just find treasures just hanging out on the shelves. Like, I've never been able to find a place where you can just wander the stacks and find like a three-volume set of The Divine Comedy from 1902. That's unheard of.
Eric Murnane is thrilled. He has just found a three-volume edition of Dante's Divine Comedy from 1902 at Powell's City of Books, as well as an edition of Walt Whitman's famous poetry collection, Leaves of Grass. Another customer, Barry Vartell, is from Colorado.
It's just a great store. It's great to see people actually coming in, browsing real
paper books, sitting down in a coffee shop and reading them there, and then choosing some to take.
What did you find today, if I may ask?
Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Thought that'd be a fun one to read, and we have a couple of used books that we bought as well.
Powell's City of Books in Portland is a unique institution. Founded in 1971, the company has been operating at the corner of Burnside Street and 10th Avenue since 1980. The shop has an estimated collection of 75,000 books, and it occupies an entire block of houses, spanning four floors and approximately 1,000 square meters. It is probably the largest bookstore in the U.S. that does not belong to any of the country's big chains. Miriam Zontz is the CEO.
You're in our literature room now, and I want to take you to our Dickens aisle.
The Dickens aisle very clearly shows just what kind of a bookstore Powell's aims to be. A 2-foot-high, 5-meter-wide shelf is reserved purely for the classic works of the English 19th-century author Charles Dickens.
Well, here we are in front of Dickens. And in most stores, if you go to look for Charles Dickens, you'll find a small collection, a single copy each of every one of his major works if you're in a good bookstore. But when you're in this bookstore, which is a great bookstore, you will find that Dickens occupies 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 shelves. And it's in all the different formats. We have hardback, we have trade paper, we have mass market, and we have all different price points. Great Expectations for $3.50. Here's a trade paperback for $9.50. $16.50, a beautiful edition.
New and old editions are deliberately placed alongside one another so that customers can immediately see the selection on offer. And they seem to appreciate it. About 5,000 people come to this bookstore every day.
We are a very user-friendly environment. People like to sit in the aisles. They like to sit on the floor. They like to, and we're in, I'm going to show you right now the coffee shop, where people are allowed to bring books in and sit and drink coffee and look at their books to decide which ones they want to buy. So we want to give people the opportunity to spend as much time at Powell's Books as they want.
And hopefully, these people will also buy their books here, instead of ordering them on Amazon. The online company is based just 300 kilometers or 170 miles north in Seattle, and is making business difficult for other booksellers, thanks to its sheer size and bargain prices.
Well, we are online, and people do choose sometimes, most of the times, to shop with us because they're making an anti-Amazon, anti-big box statement. It's a political statement. They want to support this independent bookstore in Portland, and this is another way they can help support it.
Stontz says it is vital for the bookstore to respond quickly to new trends. The presidential election, for instance, also affected book sales, prompting the store to cater to increased interest in politics.
You know, our customers, bookstores are usually bastions of liberal ideas, and so most of our customers tend to be on the more liberal side of the spectrum. So I think many of our customers were extremely depressed or despondent because of the election. On the other hand, we are a very open, and we carry all sorts of political books here, and I'm sure many of our customers supported Donald Trump or supported some Republicans, and so we try to be open to that, but at the same time, keep the conversation going. We are, as a bookstore, very concerned with freedom of speech and access to writing, and so we think it's really important that we put all viewpoints out there and let our customers read and decide on their own.
And maybe that's what's best about a bookstore like this one. No matter what topic or genre they choose, it's about giving readers the choice to make up their own minds.
I could not agree more. Nothing better than some good books to learn about lots of things and to make up your own mind. Of course, you can also just keep listening to radio and podcasts. And to revisit this edition of World in Progress or past episodes, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress. Or you can find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. For today, thanks for your interest from all of us in the studio here in Bonn, Germany. That's Eliane Giaducci, Jörg Morawetz, and me, Anke Raspa. Take care and keep reading.